This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Scientists have found signals of atmospheric carbon from hundreds of millions of years ago. It reveals our long-term climate history going back 420 million years. Humans are on track to make Earth hotter and faster than anything seen in those past eras. I have a real science interview with Dana Royer, co-author of a new paper presenting what might be called the biggest hockey stick graph. First, I have to confess that, like President Trump, I see major war as a possibility. Of course, that's partly because Trump is president. Next week, I'll explore those possibilities with scholar Michael Clare. But even the beginner's climate impacts we've had so far are threatening the tenuous order of peace. Sherry Goodman joins us. When it comes to climate and security, she's the real thing. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Maybe you've heard that climate change can be a threat multiplier. Now you are talking Sherry Goodman's language because she coined that term as her group of military experts assessed the national security risks of a shifting climate. Longtime listener and author Guy Murphy suggested Goodman as a guest. Sherry is just back from a speaking tour in Australia. It turns out Radio EcoShock guest and author of Climate Code Red, David Spratt, helped organize that tour. Sherry Goodman has worked in the Pentagon. She was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Environmental Security. From 2001 to 2015, she was Senior Vice President and General Counsel for a nonprofit group called CNA. CNA is the parent of CNA Institute for Public Research and the CNA Center for Naval Analysis. That group received federal funding to advise the United States Navy and the Marine Corps. Sherry Goodman founded and directed the CNA Military Advisory Board, and that's important because it produced two key reports on climate and security. Let's get to the big picture. Sherry Goodman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, right now, in the Middle East, it's turmoil, and across Saharan Africa, governments have failed. Millions of refugees are moving north towards security. That hasn't stopped. There were like 5,000 a couple of days ago. Where is the climate change in that picture?
Well, the climate is that's been changing is the long-term drought that underlies these conflicts. Syria experienced a long-term drought leading into the 2011 uprisings and civil war, and that underlies the instability in that country. Similarly, throughout the Arab world, in Egypt and in Tunisia, the Arab Spring uprisings were in part sparked by a prolonged drought that occurred in parts of Russia and Ukraine, China, all wheat-producing regions. In fact, Russia stopped exporting wheat in the months leading up to the Arab Spring uprisings, and it was the food insecurity, the lack of wheat to produce bread in those countries, that was the spark that lit the match there in that region.
And I would say anyone who looks into the science behind rising seas knows that the densely populated lowlands of Bangladesh are a disaster waiting to happen. But I did not know until I looked into your work that India has already built a security perimeter against climate refugees from Bangladesh. What do you know about that?
Well, it's the longest and most heavily armed, some call it climate refugee fence in the world, fencing Bangladesh on three sides, designed to keep Bangladeshis from fleeing across the border into India. As you've said, Alex, it's a very low-lying region in much of Bangladesh on the very low coastline, heavily populated in an area where rising seas, storm surge, an extreme weather event could send millions of Bangladeshis fleeing north for their safety towards the Indian border.
So why, Sherry, did you go to Australia and how did it go?
Well, I went to Australia to carry forward this conversation we've been having the last decade here in the United States and elsewhere about climate change as a national security challenge, a threat multiplier, if you will, for instability. And we see this happening increasingly, affecting our troops where they deploy, affecting our ability to respond to increasing intensity of storms, extreme weather events. And in Australia, their dynamics are in some ways similar to ours, where increasingly the country is threatened by increasingly extreme weather events. They had just had a cyclone that affected the Great Barrier Reef area, caused extensive damage and several tragedies. And they've also had prolonged drought. It's the sort of driest continent on the planet, but it's been suffering even more extreme drought. And like our own country, it also has extensive fossil resources, which it has exploited over many years, and now is coming to grips with how to effect the right balance between its energy and its climate objectives. And so we had this conversation in some of the key cities in Australia, in Sydney, in Canberra, the capital, and in Melbourne, with a great variety of leaders across civil society, the military, business, public policy, and elsewhere. And I would say that there is quite an awareness of the challenges that Australia faces from climate change. In the Asia-Pacific region, you know, Australia finds itself in what I characterized as Disaster Alley, because in the Asia-Pacific region, they already were the home to many extreme weather events, but they've been seeing more frequent intense weather events over the last decade as a result, most likely, of the warmer Pacific Ocean temperatures that fuel those storms. And so Australia is one of the key countries affected by all the intensity, both of the storms and the heavily populated, densely populated urban areas across the Asia Pacific.
Well, looking back a bit in America, I know that the administration headed by George W. Bush was not all that active on climate. What was the military thinking at the time prior to your 2007 report?
Well, you know, the thinking within the U.S. Department of Defense on climate change actually dates back several decades, and much of it began actually under the first George Bush administration, continued during the time when I was served in the 90s as in the Pentagon, was during the era where the U.S. was participating in the Kyoto Protocol negotiations, and so we began to consider how greenhouse gas emissions would apply to military operations. And then that work continued without as much visibility, but at some practical levels within planning circles within the military, and got a lot more attention within the last decade when our report was released from the CNA Military Advisory Board, National Security and the Threat to Climate Change. The Defense Department was directed by Congress the next year to include the national security implications of climate change into all its major planning documents. And the National Intelligence Council was also directed by Congress to assess the national intelligence implications of climate change in its intelligence estimates. And that led, since 2007 and 2008, to really a decade's worth of very productive work within the military and intelligence communities to understand the strategic, operational, and tactical implications of climate change at all levels of command and in all its various complexities.
So what are the major developments in the updated 2014 report, National Security and the Accelerating Risks of Climate Change?
Well, in that 2014 report, we found that risks of climate change are continuing to accelerate, that they are now a catalyst for conflict, and that one of the great concerns we identified is sort of a failure of imagination to think about how climate change could produce unexpected events, incidents, substantial risks globally in coming years. And, you know, we've often been surprised, unfortunately, as a nation, from Pearl Harbor to 9/11, history shifts in ways that are unexpected. And what we become good at is preparing to fight the last war. So I think it's hard for us to imagine exactly how climate change could become an even more substantial risk than it is today, than the gradual risk, the ones with the severe storms. But we know that the risks are continuing to mount as we see the records, the ice melting in the Arctic, at a rate more rapidly than even scientists have predicted, and faster than anywhere else on the planet, so that we now have a whole new ocean that's been created in that region, and one where we'll see a whole new set of geopolitics emerging in coming years, opportunities and risks in that region, just as an example of ways in which we have to use our imagination and good planning to understand those opportunities and risks.
Well, you know, Sherry, I'm pretty sure many of my listeners assume the first climate tragedy will hit countries far away. But has the military looked at what might happen if, say, the California drought had continued for decades or longer, or if we get a string of major hurricane hits like Katrina and Sandy all together?
Well, that's what they are beginning to do now, and I think that's very important because we need to be prepared not only for one event, but for several events, a cascading set of events potentially to occur. A prolonged drought in the West has produced an unprecedented number of wildfires, begun really to change the whole character of our Western United States. And at the same time, in the East, we see increasing number of storm events along the Atlantic coast, rising sea levels, very vulnerable regions. Our military at Norfolk Hampton Roads, which is the largest naval complex in the United States, already experiences sunny day flooding, where it floods regularly even on sunny days, and sometimes people can't get onto the base to get to work because the roads already washed out. And these challenges are only mounting. So now the military in those communities is working to reduce those risks, whether it's building higher seawalls or working to relocate infrastructure and working with the communities. And this is what I think we're going to need to do across the nation, which is look at how we build more resilient communities. And as we look at rebuilding our infrastructure in this country, whether it's roads, rails, bridges, water, electrical, other energy infrastructure, we need to ensure that it accounts for climate change and is climate smart infrastructure that enables us to be resilient in the coming years.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and my guest is lawyer and military advisor Sherry Goodman. We are talking about climate change as a threat multiplier. I find it interesting your CNA Military Advisory Board released a report in 2015 on the national security grid. Why?
Well, because the grid itself is vulnerable to both deliberate attack and to natural disasters. You know, we've experienced that in recent years, where intense storms have produced prolonged power outages. We know that it's vulnerable to cyber and other types of deliberate attack. And, you know, the military itself is, since many military bases, you know, operate off the national grid, that's a risk that the military has to protect itself against, too. So we began to look at how to reinforce a vulnerable electrical grid and how we can make our nation more secure and improve our military operations and our military performance by changing the way we think about the grid. And we see that now, that we're in the middle now of a transformation of our whole electric grid, moving towards more distributed and smart microgrids, enabling both military bases and cities not to be so dependent on one single point of failure, which is a totally connected grid. And so that's a good move. It, you know, may not occur as fast as we need it to, but, you know, you see signs of progress across the nation and certainly at our critical military installations.
Well, we just had a recent expert on the show explain that either solar storms or a hostile nuclear blast in the upper atmosphere could crash that grid and most of the electronics behind our civilization. Sherry Goodman, do you think that's a genuine worry?
Well, I think that's one of those low probability, high consequence events that we have to prepare for. I've often said that I can't compare climate risk with the risk that we face in the Cold War of a bolt out of the blue nuclear attack from the Soviet Union, where we spent billions of dollars of U.S. GDP to deter and prevent that threat of a nuclear attack. And we were fortunate. We won that war. Of course, we still face the risk of nuclear threats, and we continue to be vigilant in identifying and addressing them. With climate change, you know, we arguably face a higher probability risk, one that has equally high, if not higher, consequences for civilization. But it's one that's harder to mobilize both our nation and indeed many societies to fully address.
So when it comes to climate change outside of America, have you had much interaction or feedback from the military in other countries? What are they thinking? What can you share with us?
Well, many militaries now, Alex, include climate change within their military planning activities, particularly across Europe and in other nations as well. So we see a lot of good thinking, planning, dialogue going on. The next step really is to sort of integrate this kind of thinking at both the operational level and throughout society, and that requires sort of making hard choices about investments and looking across the range of risks. But we see, you know, a lot of good signs that thinking is occurring in the right way, and that particularly military educational institutions in many key countries from Latin America to Africa, Asia, and across Europe are beginning to understand those risks.
So how could the military help prepare civil society for the rude shocks that accompany a shift in climate?
Well, I think first, you know, the military, like any organization, needs to understand the risks to itself. So for the U.S. military, looks at the risks both to bases, as we talked about, for example, sea level rise or drought effect, and heat, for example, affects the health of our troops, both when they deploy and when they train at bases that increasingly are experiencing red flag days, temperatures consistently over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which make it a risk for troops to train for too long. So understanding risk to bases, to health, and understanding other risks, that's sort of the place one should start first, and then sharing that information with civil society and with communities. So where our bases, like at Hampton Roads in Norfolk, are working with the towns around them because they're all experiencing those same risks. And then sharing that information across militaries and sharing it in broader civilian contexts and in civil society, I think is very important.
Well, now here's a deep problem. Give me a minute here on this one. Democracies, you know, have failed to rein in greenhouse gas emissions so far. It's possible we may enter a time of repeated shocks to the system, a kind of long emergency, as Jim Kunstler called it. And maybe only the military can operate in that environment. Certainly the armed forces will be called in time and time again. And that leads to a tough question for my listeners and for all of us. If the only organization still functioning is the military, and we need some level of decision and action to save what remains of the climate, would we accept a military government? Under those extreme terms, would you, Sherry?
Well, that's not the premise on which our nation was founded, and we function very well with civilian control of the military. I think even in the current administration, while few would have predicted exactly the government we have today and its particulars of leadership, I think that there are many who remark on how well it's, you know, the military is currently being led today. I myself have great regard for Secretary Mattis and for the leadership that he and others are providing. And so I think that they're doing that in the context of now civilian leadership. And I think we train our military very well in this country so that they're amply prepared to take on a lot of leadership roles. But I think that thinking clearly about the appropriate allocation of responsibilities as between civilian and military leadership is sort of a core principle on which our democracy is founded.
I wonder how long we have left to organize rational action to save the climate that we need to survive before we're just sort of responding to emergencies and being buffeted by the climate change. What is your thinking along those lines?
I'm optimistic that, you know, we are going to move as a society in the right direction, that as we look to make our communities, and what we've seen over the last decade is that a lot of leadership on climate change and on energy and water issues is at the local level. It's at the state and local level. And I think that will continue to be the case And we've seen a lot more interesting activity at not just at the state and local level, but what people now refer to as the subnational level, where states might be working with other, let's say, a Canadian province or another state province in another country. And we've seen this exchange both of information sharing about problems, opportunities, and risks. So we see in this network world in which we live that not everything is top down anymore. There's a lot of opportunities to network across different levels and horizontal, vertical, networked, if you will, in the sort of spider web of both risks and opportunities we live. So I'm hopeful that this network world enables us to deal with the complexity of the climate and other challenges we face in a way that allows us to harness the innovation, the technology, and the adaptability that we need to thrive into the future.
I'm trying to assess where the public is when it comes to climate change and where the military is. Do you think one is ahead of the other, or are we all in this general confusion of a situation that we've never seen before in human history?
Well, look, we all face unknowns because every day we're writing the next phase of our individual and our national history. I think that the military as a planning organization has the benefit of regularly trying to peer into the future and understand what new risks are on the horizon and then bringing that learning back into it. It's not the only learning organization. I mean, many great companies, many great universities, and other organizations all function as learning organizations. And I think that is foundational, indeed fundamental, in the time in which we live, to be able to understand these new risks, adapt to them, and set our societies on a more resilient course.
Looking back in your life so far, what do you think led you into this unusual conjunction of climate and security?
Well, I have sometimes said that my career has gone from weapons to waste. I wanted, in the early part of my career, indeed always, I wanted to work on the challenges that were most important to our nation and to our society. And in the Cold War, the nuclear age, that risk and that threat seemed to be nuclear weapons and the arms control and other measures we would use by which to manage those risks. And so that's where I began my early career. I wrote a book. My first book was on the neutron bomb controversy and a case study in alliance politics. And I looked at the technology of nuclear weapons and it applied to managing the NATO alliance during the 1970s and the 1980s. I then went on to serve as the first female professional staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee during a time when the nation's nuclear weapons complex, the nuclear plants across our country at Hanford, Savannah River, Rocky Flats, and elsewhere, shut down for environment, safety, and health lapses during that period. And so as the committee and began to address those issues, take testimony, conduct hearings on those issues, we got into a range of environmental questions applying to both the Department of Energy, Department of Defense facilities. I practiced environmental law for a number of years and then moved in at the Defense Department when I went to the Pentagon to essentially being the chief environment, safety, and health officer for the nation's largest industrial organization. So since that time, I've had the privilege of working very closely with our nation's military, for whom I have deep and abiding respect. And during that era, we went from the military went from being seen in the early 1990s as an environmental laggard of sorts because there were many Superfund sites and other bases that had to be cleaned up as those laws were coming into effect and being applied to federal facilities, to being seen now as an environmental and clean energy leader. And really, the military today is seen as a forward-looking organization in this regard. In the last decade, there have been a lot of great innovations on military energy to address, improve both mission performance, cost savings, and really be at the forefront of taking technological innovations, everything from microgrids for deployed forces to solar and wind for operational and sort of city installation level use. And the military has really both benefited a great deal from that and has also been able to work with private sector and other innovators to advance this whole new area that's enabling the U.S. to be an energy superpower in a variety of ways.
You must be in a bit of a strange place now. The government you normally advise may not want your advice because they say there is no climate change, or if there is, humans are not the cause of it. Sherry Goodman, how can you proceed now?
Well, you know, our military is still very responsibly addressing these issues. Current Secretary of Defense Mattis has said that climate change poses risks to the stability of our forces where they're operating today, and that this is something that our commanders need to understand and take account for in their planning. And so I think that, this work continues at a practical level, despite the fact that there are disagreements within the current administration about how to proceed on a range of environmental issues. And I'd like to think that common sense will prevail, that American leadership is important in this area as it is in others.
Are there any final thoughts you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, you know, we all have a responsibility to engage in our communities in ways that can make a difference. This is an area where we need to all understand what the risks are and to help build more resilient societies. And I've been very privileged to work with a group of individuals across our military and in civilian society that really understand these risks but are also helping to build a resilient future, about which I am continue to be optimistic.
Our guest, Sherry Goodman, has literally been in the halls of power advising in the Pentagon and then later with a nonprofit that helps develop military planning. Sherry is a senior fellow at the Wilson Center, and you can find links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Sherry Goodman, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Okay, so why do I think there will be another popular war? And what does that tell us about climate change? President Trump has said a major conflict with North Korea is possible. He also sent more troops into the Middle East, as well as missile strikes and the mother of all bombs. But that is not why I think a popular war is coming. I've been studying the beginnings of the Crimean War, the Civil War, and the so-called Great War, World War I. It seems in every case, a technological change was sweeping through society at a time when an increasing number of people felt or were superfluous to developing change. They were left out, and they were ready to be angry at someone. There's an old saying, death loves a crowd. We don't really know why vast numbers of men and some of the women who love them decide life is not that important. They leave the possibility of love, homes, good meals, and family behind to head right into the slaughter zones. Why? How deep is that biological urge? If we have a biological urge for mass suicide, is that also a lurking force behind climate denial? We know that large numbers of Christians say that if the earth burns, it is all part of God's plan, perhaps a blessed event because it will be part of the return of Jesus. But even those with little religion can fall into the urge for death. How will they resist it as climate change promises to eradicate millions, likely hundreds of millions of humans within the next generation or two? Too many of us are apparently willing to die. They appear to find life painful, or at least not rewarding enough, to fight to live. Even the news of climate change hitting people much harder in distant lands adds to the mental pressure in everyone, I think. It's like the operation of tectonic plates. Pressure builds on the seams. Something gives, and an earthquake happens. It will not surprise me that the release of social pressure will exhibit itself as a mass desire for war. The biggest, most obvious thing can blind us so we don't see it, like the sun. Now we begin to explore science which warns, as the title in the journal Nature says, future climate forcing potentially without precedent in the last 420 million years. So during the long ages of trees and flowering plants, it has been hot before and often, but maybe not as hot as our fossil-powered civilization can make it. Our tour guide is Professor Dana Royer. He's the co-author of this new paper and a deep-time researcher at the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Wesleyan University. From Middleton, Connecticut, Dana Royer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation.
I appreciate you showing up. This is important science. It's a huge paper, as big as hundreds of millions of years, of course. And first, I think, Dana, we need to dispense with a very common misconception. When a human-made light, like a flashlight, begins to run out of energy, the light gets dimmer. But what happens as the sun ages?
Right, so the sun gets hotter, as do most stars. So our sun creates energy through fusion, converting hydrogen into helium. And helium is more dense than hydrogen, so our sun is getting denser and denser as it ages, and that causes it to heat up, kind of like a runaway train.
And it expands as well.
Yeah, eventually that's, yes.
All right, now, because the sun's power changes so slowly, the brightening of the sun has generally been left out of most climate science that I've seen. You and your team have brought it back in. Why?
Yeah, so when you want to start contemplating very long timescales, tens to hundreds of millions of years, even billions of years, then this slow change that you just mentioned, given enough time, can actually be quite large.
And it's something that maybe hasn't been calculated when people start thinking about what's going to happen in our short-term future.
That's true, yeah. Certainly the paleo climate community has been aware of the brightening of the sun, but thinking about future projections of climate change, which most of us are well aware of, putting the two together, the paleo and the potential future climate changes, thinking about how the sun evolves actually is a very useful, it's a useful way to think about the problem.
How can we possibly know how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere 100 or 400 million years ago?
That's a great question. We don't have any way to directly make these measurements, so we rely on indirect ways that we call proxies. And these, the best proxies are something that you can measure from geological materials, say a type of rock or a type of fossil. And what you're measuring, we know, at least in the present-day Earth, varies or is sensitive to CO2. So if you understand how that material, that fossil or that rock, the chemistry of a rock, how that is sensitive to CO2 on present-day Earth, then you, making some assumptions, you can start to infer what the paleo CO2 content would have been. So I work, in my own work, I think about a CO2 proxy that, I think about CO2 proxy that relies on stomatal pores on leaves. So stomates are the holes through which basically plants breathe. They take in CO2 and exhale water vapor and oxygen. And this is a very highly tuned system that is sensitive to many environmental conditions, but including CO2. So if you understand how that system works, you can go back into the geologic past where we have fossil plants and look at these fossil stomatal pores and start to uncover what the paleo CO2 content might have been deep in Earth's history.
Yeah, we got a peek at those methods about 9 years ago when I interviewed Dr. Bob Spicer, and he's working in that field as well. And I also find it interesting that there's something that leaf shape can tell us about whether they're rounded or variegated. How does that work?
Yeah, and that's something that I've worked on for quite a long time as well. So we describe the edges, the outside outline of a leaf, as either having teeth or not having teeth. So here in the northeast of the United States, maple leaves are a great example of a leaf that has teeth, little serrations. Many leaves don't have those serrations, so magnolia leaves, for example, just have a round, smooth edge. And what we find today on Earth, generally speaking, across the world, when you go to colder and colder and colder places, the percentage of species And here we're talking about the flowering plant species. The percentage of those species that have serrated margins goes up and up and up, and vice versa when you go into the tropics. So again, we can look at fossil plants, and we can look at their shapes and determine whether they have teeth along their edges or not, and that helps us to understand what the paleotemperatures might have been.
One thing I didn't totally get is, why didn't you include methane and other greenhouse gases like nitrous oxide in your study?
So, two reasons. The first is we don't have any way to infer those other greenhouse gases like we do for CO2. Maybe as our science continues to develop in the future, we might have such a proxy system. So that's certainly an important reason for why we couldn't do it. We didn't have any means to be able to assess those greenhouse gases. But second, we have a fairly good confidence that CO2 is likely to be, on these long timescales, the most important greenhouse gas. And so I think a logical argument can be made that that's what we want to focus in on, is CO2 as the main driver. With any of these sorts of analyses in deep time, there's uncertainties. And so one way that you can help get around or minimize those uncertainties is to look for big signals. So we looked at the last 400 million years where we've had big changes in CO2, fairly big changes in the sun's output. So these other factors, which we think are more secondary, while they are important and they do affect climate, they were likely smaller than the big picture, the big scale changes that we looked at with CO2 and the evolution of solar radiation.
Well, Dana Royer, looking at your paper and looking at the graphs, I was reminded of the hockey stick graph brought out years ago by our recent guest, Dr. Michael Mann. He tallied up carbon, but your paper, of course, is on a very different scale. How do these compare?
Yeah, they do have a similar visual look to them. The processes underlying them are different in the sense that the past, so with both of these hockey sticks, the long stick part, the slow, steady decline leading up to the big, abrupt rise, the historical changes, we're looking at very different types of processes. So with the hockey stick curve that you mentioned, you're looking at the last few hundred years, maybe up to the last couple thousand years. And the processes on Earth that control the level of CO2 in the atmosphere over those short time scales is very different than what we're looking at over these multi-million year time scales. So on the shorter time scales, the parts of the carbon cycle that are important are the processes that I think most people are aware of. You have plants taking up CO2, you have CO2 dissolving into the ocean or degassing back into the atmosphere. You have carbon moving between the ocean, atmosphere, the land, and the biota that is on land and in the ocean. On geologic timescales, there are additional processes that become quite important. And these processes control how carbon moves from these surface reservoirs, the ocean, atmosphere, and land, how carbon moves from those places to the deep earth, buried as rock, either in organic form, so fossil fuels would be one example, but there's a lot of organic rich rocks, for example, shales and slates, and also carbon buried as rocks in inorganic form. Limestone is a great example. Chemically, this is calcium carbonate. It has carbon in it. So the movement or the exchange of carbon from these deep earth reservoirs, which are very large, to the surface of the earth, which again I include the ocean, the atmosphere, and the land. That's what controls CO2 in the atmosphere on these geologic timescales. So very fundamentally different than on the shorter timescales.
Now, there have been more hothouse periods than icehouse times. It's been hotter, and the carbon dioxide levels have been as much as 10 times higher than our pre-industrial levels of 280 parts per million. Earth survived. So why should we worry if CO2 levels go up to 600 parts per million or 1,000?
Yes, a great question, and certainly a question that's asked very frequently. So life survives. I don't know of any climate scientists that would argue that that's what we're worrying about, or that we're fearful about, that, you know, all life is going to cease to exist. I don't think that's in the cards. But the many parts of the Earth system are going to change. They're going to shift. And so it's a question of how you could think about it from our perspective as humans, how we are going to fit into this altered Earth, and whether that's a place that will be easy to fit into or create a lot of stress. You could also think of it in terms of all the other species on Earth. And I think a very important, another important dimension here is how fast the changes are taking place. So it is true that in Earth's past, we've had levels of CO2, as you said, upwards of 10 times higher than today, so several thousand parts per million. That's happened in the past. It may happen again in our future, depending on what our actions as the human collective is going to be. But the rate of change is very, very different. So in the geologic past, as best as we can tell, the very quickest changes happened on 1,000-year timescales. So the fastest events where Earth suffered a lot of stress, often associated with mass extinctions, those events happened on timescales of thousands of years. What's unfolding today is happening on 100-year timescales, and that's very different. May not sound like a big difference, but it actually is. For example, the oceans on Earth circulate, and they like a big conveyor belt. They take water from the surface part of the ocean, and then bring it into the deep ocean. And that's a way to transport not only water, but everything that's dissolved in that water, including a lot of carbon. So if we dump a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, as we're doing now, one way in which that carbon is soaked up is by dissolving into the ocean. This is actually what's causing the acidification of the ocean. But it is taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. The deep ocean, in terms of its volume, is much, much larger than the surface ocean. But it takes about 1,000 years for this one cycle of this circulation to take place. So if we start, as we are, loading CO2 into the atmosphere faster than the ocean circulates, that means that for some period of time in our near future, the CO2 concentrations are going to be higher than they would be if we burn the same amount of fossil fuels and put the same amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, but did it much more slowly, allowing the ocean to circulate and pull more of that CO2 into the deep ocean. So this is getting a bit off topic from the paper, but I think it's a very important point that the rate of change is fundamentally important. And for many people, myself included, this is one major source of concern for why, you know, potential future changes, why we should be very mindful of what they are.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from Wesleyan University, Professor Dana Royer. We're talking about the way humans could create a warming knot seed in the last 420 million years and the research behind that. And a second critical point I noticed, Dana, which you emphasize in the paper, is that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been overall in a gradual decline for the last few hundred million years. Why would that happen?
Yeah, great question. So as we were talking earlier, the sun has been getting brighter. And so what that means, so it's creating more and more energy. And so more watts are being received by the Earth's surface. More energy is being received by the Earth's surface as the sun has gone through its evolution. So this means that in Earth's past, let's say 100 million years ago, let's imagine a scenario where CO2 is exactly the same as today. The Earth would have been cooler 100 million years ago than it is today, even though the CO2 concentrations in this theoretical example were identical. It's because the sun wasn't as bright. So as you mentioned, what we see from the proxy records of CO2 is, on average, there's ups and downs, but on average, CO2 has been declining over the last 400 million years. So what's going on there? So CO2 over these very long timescales is controlled, as I was just mentioning, by processes that move carbon from the surface Earth to the deep, the rock reservoirs deep in the Earth's crust. And one very important way by which this happens is by the conversion, or what we call the chemical weathering, the conversion of rock into soil. So this is happening all the time, and there are certain kinds of rocks that when this chemical weathering takes place and you're forming soil, you're actually pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. When you turn rock into soil, you're not only forming the solid particles that we see as soil, but you're also forming a lot of dissolved, what we call ions. And this is what ultimately makes our oceans salty. Sodium and chloride are two examples of ions that are very common on Earth. But there's also an important ion that has carbon in it called bicarbonate. And when you weather these kinds of rocks, which are very common on the Earth's surface today, you form this bicarbonate, which came originally from the atmosphere in the form of CO2. And then through chemical weathering, it turns into this dissolved ion, bicarbonate. And then this eventually, over time, makes its way to the ocean. And bicarbonate is the fundamental building block for making shells, this calcium carbonate. You need bicarbonate. That's the building block for making these shells. And if these shells get buried, you know, the organisms that make them will die, and then the shells drift to the bottom of the ocean, and some amount of these shells will get buried and eventually turned into rock, for example, limestone. And this is a way to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's kind of a long story there, but that process of chemical weathering isn't constant over geologic time. It varies for a variety of reasons, but one important reason is climate. So temperature does affect how fast rock turns into soil. And as you might guess, when it gets hotter, those reactions go faster. Like many chemical reactions, when it gets hotter, this particular chemical reaction goes faster. And now remember, that's pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. So if the climate is hot because CO2 is high, that's going to cause the chemical weathering to increase, which will cause more CO2 to be pulled out of the atmosphere, diminishing. If you had a rise in CO2, this chemical weathering is a way to pull back down that CO2 and keep it within certain bounds. And so we see this kind of interplay, or this dance between the evolution of the sun and the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere as moderated or mediated by chemical weathering. And the two are linked via climate. And it keeps which draws down the CO2 over those long timescales.
You know, when you talk like that, you remind me of James Lovelock, who observed that the living and the non-living forces on Earth seem to have conspired to keep the environment within the bounds required by life. I mean, it must be so. Life has continued for so long. I know this isn't part of your paper, but what do you think?
Yeah, that's an area I haven't spent too much time thinking, you know, too deeply about. Certainly on, you know, if you could kind of take a dispassion view of that, those are the links that we see. Now, whether you want to argue that life is somehow conspiring to do this explicitly, I think that's perhaps something that I can't speak too directly about. But it's certainly an intriguing idea, and I think, I don't know, for me, more importantly, just the system that we have, this Earth system, does have these moderating processes, what we call negative feedbacks, that keep the conditions of on Earth, on the surface of the Earth, within certain bounds, which certainly is a plus, is a good thing for most life on Earth, right?
Yeah. Well, now, it seems like most of the things that we see on the larger scale, at least, have developed in the last half a billion years, the living things. So I'm wondering, is there any point in searching for climate models even earlier? Would anyone try to reconstruct the record of carbon dioxide much older than your study did?
Well, I think our community would be very keen to try to do that. There is an interest in understanding climates even older than what we've been talking about today. There was not complex life, but there certainly was life going back at least 3.5 billion years. And so understanding the interplay between bacterial life and climate is of interest to many people. There are also at least two times in Earth's history where Earth got very, very cold. They call these snowball Earth events. And so there certainly has been a focus on trying to understand what CO2 might have been through those snowball Earth events. It gets tricky, you know, as you go further and further back in time, we have less rock that we can study. And our proxy systems, as you go further and further back in time, become less certain. You know, the errors tend to go up. Sometimes based on what you're, you know, if your proxy is dependent on a particular kind of fossil, at some point going back in Earth's history, that fossil group isn't going to be around, right? It evolved at some period in Earth's history, so before that time, you're not going to be able to use your proxy system. So the number of tools we have, they become scarce. The amount of actual material, rock material, becomes more scarce. So it becomes a bit of an elusive thing. But I can tell you that, you know, if we could wave our magic wand and have our way, you know, we certainly would have a strong interest in trying to reconstruct these climates from even deeper periods in Earth's history.
And, you know, as I said at the start, some of this seems so obvious. The sun is brighter now, so if we increase the carbon blanket, that will make things even hotter. And yet I don't recall reading about this in the latest assessment by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It is a big report. Did I miss it, or is this important factor missing?
Yeah, I don't believe it's in the IPCC reports. The main focus of the IPCC is understanding kind of the next 100 years of our climate and where it may be headed. So the evolution of the sun is slow enough that's not something that they need to take into account. You know, the sun's output does vary on shorter timescales, sunspots and that sort of thing, and certainly the IPCC has addressed that sort of variability. But this very long-term, almost monotonic change is, I think, for a good reason. They haven't, it's not something that they really need to be aware of. But, where our new study does interface with the folks who are potentially interested in the IPCC reports is thinking about how what we would call the radiative forcing, basically the temperature, but we view it in terms of the radiative forcing, watts per meter squared, how our future trajectories may put us on course to radiative forcings that are highly, highly unusual on geologic timescales.
Your paper mentions a time when the Earth was 10 degrees C hotter than it is today. A few scientists I've talked to suggest human civilization, maybe our whole species, could not survive even 6 degrees of warming. I wonder if it's possible, if we didn't survive maybe there would be no trace at all of this brief burst of unnatural warming.
Yeah, that's an interesting point to ponder. We know from looking at rocks, doing our studies today, that it is hard to discern very, very rapid change. What we usually focus on are the type of rocks called sedimentary rocks. So these are rocks that were originally laid down as sediments. But these are not perfect recorders, these sedimentary archives. For example, sediments that drift to the bottom of the ocean will often get churned by organisms. They call this bioturbation. And for a geologist, this means that your time resolution coarsens. You don't have you can't resolve short, sharp changes as well because it's been smeared or mixed by this biological mixing process. But there are some archives for lakes are often quite good recorders where you can get annual resolutions. So these archives do exist, but they're fairly rare. But getting to your question, you know, would we be able to see something on sort of 100-year timescales? Maybe, but you would have to have an ideal sedimentary archive in order to do it.
All right. Well, I hope that doesn't happen. Now, I have one last little bit of doubt, and that is, can we really apply climate physics of hundreds of millions of years to such a short blip as our current century? I mean, I worry very different timescales can make calculations with such large margins of error, they're almost meaningless. Is that a legitimate concern?
It is a concern, and I think what we can rest my group that the study that we worked on here, you know, the fact that we're looking at very big signals. You know, it's all about signal to noise ratio, right? And what your question is touching on the noise part of that ratio, right? And so if we were looking at small changes in CO2, small changes in the solar output, then I think your question would be something that we would want to be very concerned about, you know, whether we can actually pull out a true signal because of all the noise in that system. But despite these uncertainties, if your signal is big enough, and so, you know, our records that we used in this study, we're looking at changes in CO2 on the order of thousands of parts per million, and we were looking at changes in solar output that are, you know, the equivalent of about 10 watts per meter squared. So in terms of CO2, that's about two CO2 doublings. So big changes. So it's something that we're always aware of, and mindful of, and a little bit worried about. But we try to pick, because of those concerns, we try to pick events or intervals of time where we're going to generate or be able to look at large signals.
What will you be working on next?
Gosh, I'm not sure. I am very, very, very interested in this relationship between CO2 and temperature. I've done some recent work on trying to understand what these deep time archives can tell us about climate sensitivity. So that's the general notion of if CO2 changes, how much change in temperature can we expect? In these deep time records, particularly if you can look at periods of time where you have a big signal, getting back to the point I was just making, we can actually, despite all the uncertainties with these temperature proxies and CO2 proxies, we can actually make some reasonably precise estimates of climate sensitivity. And that's something, climate sensitivity, that not only deep time scientists are interested in, but people interested in present day climate change are very interested in as well.
We've been speaking with Professor Dana Royer from the Wesleyan University in Connecticut. He's a co-author of a time-breaking paper in Nature. The title is Future Climate Forcing Potentially Without Precedent in the last 420 million years. You can find details in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Dana, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for the invitation.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Download all the past shows you want free at ecoshock.org. And let's meet again next week.